6. The Ambassador. It was 10 hours before Younes had his interview with the clerk that Terrans left Korov's bakery. Terrans kept a hand on the rough surfaces of the workers' hovels he passed, as he stepped gingerly along the alleys of the city. Except for the pale light that washed down in a periodic glimmer from the upper city, he was in total darkness. What light might exist in lower city would be the pearly flashes of the patrollers, marching in twos and threes. Lower city lay like a slumbering, noxious monster, its greasy coils hidden by the glittering cover of upper city. Parts of it probably maintained a shadowy life as produce was brought in and stored for the coming day, but that was not here, not in the slums. Terrans shrank into a dusty alley. Even the nightly showers of Florina could scarcely penetrate into the shadowy regions beneath the cement alloy, as the distant clank of footsteps reached him. Lights appeared, passed, and disappeared 100 yards away. All night long, the patrollers marched back and forth. They needed only to march. The fear they inspired was strong enough to maintain order with scarcely any display of force. With no city lights, the darkness might well be cover for innumerable crawling humans, but even without patrollers as a distant threat, that danger could have been discounted. The food stores and workshops were well guarded. The luxury of upper city was unattainable, and to steal from one another, to parasitize on one another's misery, was obviously futile. What would be considered crime on other worlds was virtually non-existent here in the dark. The poor were at hand, but had been picked clean, and the rich were strictly out of reach. Terrans flitted on, his face gleaming white when he passed under one of the openings in the cement alloy above, and he could not help but look up. Out of reach. Were they indeed out of reach? How many changes in attitude toward the squires of Sark had he endured in his life? As a child, he had been but a child. Patrollers were monsters in black and silver, from whom one fled as a matter of course, whether one had done wrong or not. The squires were misty and mystical supermen, enormously good, who lived in a paradise known as Sark and brooded watchfully and patiently over the welfare of the foolish men and women of Florina. He would repeat every day in school, "May the spirit of the galaxy watch over the squires as they watch over us." Yes, he thought now, exactly, exactly. Let the spirit be to them as they to us, no more and no less. His fists clenched and burned in the shadows. When he was 10, he had written an essay for school about what he imagined life to be like on Sark. It had been a work of purely creative imagination, designed to show off his penmanship. He remembered very little, only one passage, in fact. In that, he described the squires gathering every morning in a great hall with colors like those of the kirk blossoms and standing about gravely in 20-foot-high splendor, debating on the sins of the Florinians and sorrowfully somber over the necessities of winning them back to virtue. The teacher had been very pleased, and at the end of the year, when the other boys and girls proceeded with their short sessions on reading, writing, and morality, he had been promoted to a special class where he learned arithmetic, galactography, and Sarkite history. At the age of 16, he had been taken to Sark. He could still remember the greatness of that day, and he shuddered away from the memory. The thought of it shamed him. Terrans was approaching the outskirts of the city now. An occasional breeze brought him the heavy night odor of the kirk blossoms. A few minutes now, and he would be out in the relative safety of the open fields, where there were no regular patroller beats, and where, through the ragged night clouds, he could see the stars again. Even the hard, bright yellow star that was Sark's sun. It had been his for half his life, when he first saw it through a spaceship's porthole as more than a star, as an unbearably bright little marble. He wanted to get on his knees. The thought that he was approaching paradise removed even the paralyzing fright of his first space flight. He had landed on his paradise and been delivered to an old Florinian who saw to it that he was bathed and clothed becomingly. He was brought to a large building, and on the way there, his elderly guide had bowed low to a figure that passed. "Bow!" the old one muttered angrily to the young Terrans. Terrans did so and was confused. Who was that? A squire, you ignorant farmhand? He? A squire? He stopped dead in his tracks and had to be urged forward. It was his first sight of a squire. Not 20 feet tall at all, but a man like men. Other Florinian youths might have recovered from the shock of such a disillusion, but not Terran's. Something changed inside him, changed permanently. In all the training he received, through all the studies in which he did so well, he never forgot that squires were men. For 10 years he studied, and when he neither studied nor ate nor slept, he was taught to make himself useful in many small ways. He was taught to run messages and empty wastebaskets, to bow low when a squire passed, and to turn his face respectfully to the wall when a squire's lady passed. For 5 more years he worked in the civil service, shifted as usual from post to post in order that his capacities might best be tested under a variety of conditions. A plump, soft Florinian visited him once, smiling his friendship, pinching his shoulder gently, and asked what he thought of the squires. Terence repressed a desire to turn away and run. He wondered if his thoughts could have imprinted themselves in some obscure code upon the lines of his face. He shook his head, murmured a string of banalities on the goodness of the squires. But the plump one stretched his lips and said, "You don't mean that. Come to this place tonight." He gave him a small card that crumbled and charred in a few minutes. Terence went. He was afraid, but very curious. There he met friends of his, who looked at him with secrecy in their eyes, and who met him at work later with bland glances of indifference. He listened to what they said, and found that many seemed to believe what he had been hoarding in his own mind, and honestly had thought to be his own creation and no one else's. He learned that at least some Florinians thought the squires to be vile brutes, who milked Florina of its riches for their own useless good while they left the hard-working natives to wallow in ignorance and poverty. He learned that the time was coming when there would be a giant uprising against Sark, and all the luxury and wealth of Florina would be appropriated by their rightful owners. "How?" Terence asked. He asked it over and over again. After all, the squires and the patrollers had the weapons. And they told him of Trantor, of the gigantic empire that had swollen in the last few centuries until half the inhabited worlds of the galaxy were part of it. Trantor, they said, would destroy Sark with the help of the Florinians. But, said Terence, first to himself, then to others, if Trantor was so large and Florina so small, would not Trantor simply replace Sark as a still larger and more tyrannical master? If that were the only escape, Sark was to be endured in preference. Better the master they knew than the master they knew not. He was derided and dejected, with threats against his life if he ever talked of what he had heard. But some time afterward, he noted that one by one, those of the conspiracy disappeared, until only the original plump one was left. Occasionally, he saw that one whisper to some newcomer here and there. But it would not have been safe to warn the young victim that he was being presented with a temptation and a test. He would have to find his own way, as had Terence. Terence even spent some time in the Department of Security, which only a few Florinians could ever expect to accomplish. It was a short stay, for the power attached to an official in security was such that the time spent there by any individual was even shorter than elsewhere. But here Terence found, somewhat to his surprise, that there were real conspiracies to be countered. Somehow men and women met on Florina and plotted rebellion. Usually these were surreptitiously supported by Trantorian money. Sometimes the would-be rebels actually thought Florina would succeed unaided. Terence meditated on the matter. His words were few, his bearing correct, but his thoughts ranged unchecked. The squires he hated, partly because they were not 20 feet tall, partly because he might not look at their women, and partly because he had served a few with bowed head, and had found that for all their arrogance they were foolish creatures, no better educated than himself, and usually far less intelligent. Yet what alternative to this personal slavery was there? To exchange the stupid Sarkite squire for the stupid Trantorian imperial was useless. To expect the Florinian peasants to do something on their own was fantastically foolish. So there was no way out. It was the problem that had been in his mind for years, as student, as petty official, and as townman. And then there had arisen the peculiar set of circumstances that put an undreamed-of answer in his hands in the person of this insignificant-looking man who had once been a spatio-analyst and who now babbled of something that put the life of every man and woman on Florina in danger. Terrans was out in the fields now, where the night rain was ending and the stars gleamed wetly among the clouds. He breathed deeply of the kirt that was Florina's treasure and her curse. He was under no illusions. He was no longer a townman. He was not even a free Florinian peasant. He was a criminal on the run, a fugitive who must hide. Yet there was a burning in his mind. For the last 24 hours he had had in his hands the greatest weapon against Sark anyone could have dreamed of. There was no question about it. He knew that Rick remembered correctly, that he had been a spatio-analyst once, that he had been psycho-probed into near brainlessness, and that what he remembered was something true and horrible and powerful. He was sure of it. And now this Rick was in the thick hands of a man who pretended to be a Florinian patriot, but was actually a Trentorian agent. Terrans felt the bitterness of his anger in the back of his throat. Of course this Baker was a Trentorian agent. He had had no doubt about that from the first moment. Who else among dwellers in the lower city would have the capital to build dummy radar ovens? He could not allow Rick to fall into the hands of Trantor. He would not allow Rick to fall into the hands of Trantor. There was no limit to the risks he was prepared to run. What matter the risks? He had incurred the death penalty already. There was a dim gleam in the corner of the sky. He would wait for dawn. The various patroller stations would have his description, of course, but it might take several minutes for his appearance to register, and during those several minutes he would be a townman. It would give him time to do something that even now he did not dare let his mind dwell upon. It was 10 hours after Yuntz had had his interview with the clerk that he met Ludigan Abel again. The ambassador greeted Yuntz with his usual surface cordiality, yet with a definite and disturbing sensation of guilt. At their first meeting, it had been a long time ago, nearly a standard year had passed, he had paid no attention to the man's story, per se. His only thought had been, will this or can this help Trantor? Trantor. It was always first in his thought. Yet he was not the kind of fool who would worship a cluster of stars, or the yellow emblem of spaceship and sun that the Trantorian armed forces wore. In short, he was not a patriot in the ordinary meaning of the word, and Trantor as Trantor meant nothing to him. But he did worship peace. All the more so because he was growing old and enjoyed his glass of wine, his atmosphere saturated with mild music and perfume, his afternoon nap and his quiet wait for death. It was how he imagined all men must feel. Yet all men suffered war and destruction. They died frozen in the vacuum of space, vaporized in the blast of exploding atoms, famished on a besieged and bombarded planet. How then to enforce peace? Not by reason, certainly, nor by education. If a man could not look at the fact of peace and the fact of war and choose the former in preference to the latter, what additional argument could persuade him? What could be more eloquent as a condemnation of war than war itself? What tremendous feat of dialectic could carry with it a tenth the power of a single gutted ship with its ghastly cargo? So then, to end the misuse of force, only one solution was left. Force itself. Abel had a map of Trantor in his study, so designed as to show the application of that force. It was a clear crystalline ovoid in which the galactic lens was three-dimensionally laid out. Its stars were specks of white diamond dust, its nebulae patches of light or dark fog, and near its central depths there were the few red specks that had been the Trantorian Republic. Not were, but had been. The Trantorian Republic had been a mere 5 worlds, 500 years earlier. But it was a historical map, and showed the Republic at that stage only when the dial was set at 0, Advance the dial one notch, and the pictured galaxy would be as it was 50 years later, and a sheaf of stars would redden about Trantor's rim. In 10 stages, half a millennium would pass, and the crimson would spread like a widening bloodstain, until more than half the galaxy had fallen into the red puddle. That red was the red of blood in more than a fanciful way. As the Trantorian Republic became the Trantorian Confederation, and then the Trantorian Empire, its advance had lain through a tangled forest of gutted men, gutted ships, and gutted worlds. Yet through it all, Trantor had become strong, and within the red there was peace. Now, Trantor trembled at the brink of a new conversion, from Trantorian Empire to Galactic Empire. And then the red would engulf all the stars, and there would be universal peace, Pax Trantorica. Abel wanted that. 500 years ago, 400 years ago, even 200 years ago, he would have opposed Trantor as an unpleasant nest of nasty, materialistic, and aggressive people, careless of the rights of others, imperfectly democratic at home, though quick to see the minor slaveries of others, and greedy without end. But the time had passed for all that. He was not for Trantor, but for the all-embracing end that Trantor represented. So the question, how will this help galactic peace, naturally became, how will this help Trantor? The trouble was that in this particular instance he could not be certain. To Yuntz, the solution was obviously a straightforward one. Trantor must uphold the ISB and punish Sark. Possibly this would be a good thing if something could definitely be proven against Sark. Possibly not, even then. Certainly not if nothing could be proven. But in any case, Trantor could not move rashly. All the galaxy could see that Trantor stood at the edge of galactic dominion, and there was still a chance that what yet remained of the non-Trantorian planets might unite against that. Trantor could win even such a war, but perhaps not without paying a price that would make victory only a pleasanter name for defeat. So Trantor must never make an incautious move in this final stage of the game. Abel had therefore proceeded slowly, casting his gentle web across the labyrinth of the civil service and the glitter of the Sarkite squiredom, probing with a smile and questioning without seeming to. Nor did he forget to keep the fingers of the Trantorian Secret Service upon Yuntz himself, lest the angry Liberian do in a moment damage that Abel could not repair in a year. Abel was astonished at the Liberian's persistent anger. He had asked him once, "Why does one agent concern you so?" He had expected a speech on the integrity of the ISB and the duty of all to uphold the Bureau as an instrument not of this world or that, but of all humanity. He did not get it. Instead, Yuntz frowned and said, "Because at the bottom of all this lies the relationship between Sark and Florina. I want to expose that relationship and destroy it." Abel felt nothing less than nausea. Always, everywhere, there was this preoccupation with single worlds that prevented over and over again any intelligent concentration upon the problem of galactic unity. Certainly social injustices existed here and there. Certainly they seemed sometimes impossible to stomach. But who could imagine that such injustice could be solved on any scale less than galactic? First, there must be an end to war and national rivalry, and only then could one turn to the internal miseries that, after all, had external conflict as their chief cause. And Yuntz was not even of Florina. He had not even that cause for emotionalized short-sightedness. Abel said, "What is Florina to you?" Yuntz hesitated. He said, "I feel a kinship. But you are a Liberian, or at least that is my impression." "I am. But there lies the kinship. We are both extremes in a galaxy of the average." "Extremes? I don't understand." Yuntz said, "In skin pigmentation. They are unusually pale. We are unusually dark. It means something. It binds us together. It gives us something in common. It seems to me our ancestors must have had long histories of being different, even of being excluded from the social majority. We are unfortunate whites and darks, brothers in being different. By that time, under Abel's astonished gaze, Yuntz stumbled to a halt. The subject had never been sounded again. And now, after a year, without warning, without any previous intimations, just at the point where perhaps a quiet trailing end might be expected of the whole wretched matter, and where even Yuntz showed signs of flagging zeal, it all exploded. He faced a different Yuntz now, one whose anger was not reserved for Sark, but spilled and overflowed onto Abel as well. "It is not," the Liberian said in part, "that I resent the fact that your agents have been set upon my heels. Presumably you are cautious and must rely on nothing and nobody. Good as far as that goes. But why was I not informed as soon as our man was located?" Abel's hand smoothed the warm fabric of the arm of his chair. "Matters are complicated. Always complicated. I had arranged that any report on an unauthorized seeker after spatio-analytic data be reported to certain of my own agents as well as to you. I even thought you might need protection. But on Florina," Yuntz said bitterly, "yes, we were fools not to have considered that. We spent nearly a year proving we could find him nowhere on Sark. He had to be on Florina, and we were blind to that. In any case, we have him now, or you have, and presumably it will be arranged to have me see him." Abel did not answer directly. He said, "You say they told you this man Koroff was a Trantorian agent. Isn't he? Why should they lie? Or are they misinformed?" "They neither lie nor are they misinformed. He has been an agent of ours for a decade, and it is disturbing to me that they were aware of it. It makes me wonder what more they know of us and how shaky our structure may be altogether. But doesn't it make you wonder why they told you baldly that he was one of our men? Because it was the truth, I imagine, and to keep me once and for all from embarrassing them by further demands that could only cause trouble between themselves and Trantor. Truth is a discredited commodity among diplomats, and what greater trouble can they cause for themselves than to let us know the extent of their knowledge about us, to give us the opportunity before it is too late to draw in our damaged net, mend it, and put it out whole again?" "Then answer your own question."
"I say they told you of their knowledge of Koroff's true identity as a gesture of triumph. They knew that the fact of their knowledge could no longer either help or harm them, since I have known for 12 hours that they knew Koroff was one of our men."
"But how?"
"By the most unmistakable hint possible. Listen, 12 hours ago, Matt Koroff, agent for Trantor, was killed by a member of the Florinian patrol. The two Florinians he held at the time, a woman and the man who in all probability is the field man you have been seeking, are gone, vanished. Presumably they are in the hands of the squires."
Yuntz cried out and half rose from his seat. Abel lifted a glass of wine to his lips calmly and said,
"There is nothing I can do officially. The dead man was a Florinian, and those who have vanished, for all we can prove to the contrary, are likewise Florinians. So, you see, we have been badly outplayed, and are now being mocked in addition."